So clearly globally we need to find our path to using energy supplies that are cost effective in achieving clean, dynamic and resilient energy economies that are dominated by renewables like solar and wind instead of fossil fuels. And this is an area the banking sector can play an influential role in.
Hello and welcome to the Brentas Foundation podcast, where we throw light on some of the African continent's biggest and most pressing issues and leverage best practice, not just on what to do, but how to do it. I'm your host, Marino Ngoklo, and it's a pleasure to share in this moment with you. If you're new here, welcome. It's nice to have you here. If you're a regular, hey, how's it going? So this is the podcast where I share a lot of the super interesting conversations I have with really cool people. I'm a firm believer in sharing ideas that shape and challenge the world as we know it. My hope is that these conversations, where you get to be a fly on the wall, start further and deeper conversations wherever you are and lead to the exploring of actions and ideas that actually work and make a difference. So without further ado, let's get straight into it. Again, I'm Marie Noel and you're listening to the Brentas Foundation podcast. Okay, so in today's episode, we'll be speaking about the financial services sector and its support to the economy, focusing specifically on South Africa. So I have the privilege of speaking with Annabelle Bishop, who made the chapter contribution to the book Better Choices, Ensuring South Africa's Future. Now, why this chat in the first place? Great question. So the financial sector, really, as most people would know, is a key pillar of the South African economy or anywhere else. There's a lot of technical speak and jargon around how it supports and contributes to economic growth. This conversation really is an attempt to get some insight on the state of the financial services sector or system in South Africa now, what needs to be done, what are some of the top things that government needs to do or consider, and how these are likely to impact the state of affairs. Annabelle is well versed in the affairs of the financial sector as the chief economist for Investec Bank Limited in South Africa. Her work involves dealing with clients directly, informing and presenting on various topics in the economy, as well as authoring a wide range of in-house and external articles, including forecasts of up to 5 years on the future of the South African economy, both financial market variables and general macroeconomic data as well. Of course, and as well as scenarios and trend analysis. So this makes a very interesting conversation. I'm excited to bring Annabelle on here to share from her chapter contribution. And I hope you enjoyed this chat as well. So without further ado, let's get straight to the chat with Annabelle Bishop.
Annabelle, thank you so much for joining me today. How are you doing?
I'm fine, thank you. And yourself?
I'm very well, thank you. All right, so to get us a bit warmed up, I thought we could engage in a very quick game to familiarize the audience and me, really, with who you are. Are you ready? It's kind of like rapid fire, but it's interesting questions.
Okay, go for it.
All right, awesome. So what was the first job on your resume?
First job on my resume was working for a little bank called McCarthy Bank. It was a tiny little bank in Natal, in KwaZulu-Natal, but it did get taken out by the financial market crisis that happened shortly thereafter in 1998-99.
Oh, wow. Well, that's some intro into the sector. How many languages do you speak?
I speak 2.5, I'd say. You know, we were all sort of forced to speak Afrikaans at school, and unfortunately I've had to keep it up because there's some people in my life who only want to speak Afrikaans. But I'm also learning another language as well. I'm trying to learn German, and that's you know, my father's side of the family. So yeah, I'm trying, but I think it's a bit hard, you know, given everything else on my plate, to commit full-time to language learning.
Yeah, no, definitely. All right. Do you have any hobbies or skills that most people don't know about you?
Well, you know, I'm a mom and I'm a wife, so I know how to do all the household stuff. But, you know, also when I was a child, I used to do a lot of horse riding, a lot of competing. And as an adult, I like mountain biking. I've had quite a bit of asthma in the last several months, so I haven't been able to do it. But before that, I used to do a lot of mountain biking, and I certainly enjoy hiking, walking in nature, you know, walking in the Drakensberg. I mean, South Africa is such a beautiful country.
Right. Yeah, no, I couldn't agree more. Right. What describes your, you know, your work day, if there's any such standard day?
I think anything that comes across my desk. You know, last week I was asked to do, I was asked to do a submission to the DTI on some areas that they're working on. And then I was also asked to look at a banking association's report on climate change. I've been doing quite a lot of work on climate change. And then also last week as well, I had to, delve down into quite a few different areas. And of course, you know, mainly we do quite a lot of regulatory work. So we do a lot of econometric work, modeling, looking at different scenarios. And of course, I try and put out a note each day as well, a short note to the markets. And then, you know, we have a lot of media and, client interaction. So it's very varied.
Yeah. No, at least, well, I hope that's helpful. It keeps you sort of interested in quite a number of different things. Okay, Annabelle, are you a zero inbox person? Or do you have 1,059?
I'm sorry. I'm a zero inbox person.
Great.
How did you know?
I'm like, you can always tell. But no, I'm a zero inbox person myself.
Okay.
I'm like, my inbox is my to-do list. So we just work through that and that's that. I cannot have 1,051 notifications. It doesn't work.
No. I do have a big archive system where I file away all my different emails for referring to, if that answers your question.
Yeah, no, definitely. Right. So what's the one skill that you maybe underestimated earlier on, but you found has served you really well at work?
I think just a very good memory. You know, you need to remember what happened in past years in the economy. You need to be able to remember all the different parts of the economy, you know, how it all operates and works. And I suppose multitasking as well, you know, being able to do many different things at the same time, working on many different projects, you know, just basically having good memory retention and, you know, good multitasking ability.
Yeah, no, that's excellent. All right. What was the last aha moment you had and what was that about?
Probably in my climate change work, you know, I've been doing a lot of reading on climate change. We've been doing a lot of scenarios for it. It's obviously becoming something quite necessary for the banking environment. We look at the national framework for greening of the financial services sector. It's a set of scenarios that they've put together. We run through our banks, our models, our economies. Obviously, you add and change things to customize it to your country. And, you know, really just, I think, having a good read through climate change. But, you know, the aha moment was really seeing how the Russian-Ukraine war has actually caused a lot of climate change targets almost to be pushed back in a way. There's also, interestingly, at a summit in Bonn recently, low appetite for, as you would expect in the current environment, increased taxes on fossil fuels. I mean, we've obviously seen all the fossil fuel prices go up anyway because of the Russian-Ukraine war. And of course, now Europe obviously looking to increase its gas infrastructure, which is not part of its climate change agreement. So it's supposed to be reducing infrastructure in those areas. So I think all of that, you know, quite interesting. And just really, you know, talking about the aha moment was scientists saying, well, they think because of all this, we're on the hothouse track, which is the worst scenario. You know, it's a 3 to 4 degrees warming since the Industrial Revolution out to 2100. It was an aha moment thinking, you know, the politicians are not really driving towards a solution in the near term. It continues to be pushed out, continues to be deferred. And I think that's worrying.
Yeah, no, definitely. That's a big one. And you are right. It's, you know, a lot of people talking about preparing themselves in the event that they can't get gas and yada, 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 and the impact that has had. I mean, that's something else that we now are back on the track, the track that we've been trying to avoid for the past, you know, few years. And so many people have dedicated efforts to. Slightly terrifying, actually. But yeah. All right. So the last question I have for you, Annabelle, is what comes to mind when you hear Africa in 2050?
Oh, is climate change again, because that's really been a huge topic for me at the moment. You know, we do run scenarios, other scenarios as well for economic risks and obviously for how we feel the economy will perform as our expected case, you know, different up and down scenarios. But I think, you know, for Africa in 2050, you know, given Africa's extremely rapid population growth rate, you know, the number of people coming in, the inability of the continent really even just to cope now in some areas. areas because of climate change, and obviously the impact on food, on droughts we're talking about here. And then, of course, you know, looking out to 2050, there'll be a lot more people, and the environment will battle even more, you know, from a food sustainability perspective. You know, those sort of things I think are quite concerning, because I don't see much solid preparation or planning in these countries. In fact, if you actually look at the climate change work that's been done, you know, by a lot of scientists, a lot of agriculturists, or, you know, around the world, they say the low-income economies or poor economies are the ones that often have the more extreme climate change effects. And then you're loading that on top of them, you know, obviously battling with large populations, often low incomes, and then, of course, you know, weaknesses in government finances. So I think all of that is a concern for me. And I still feel that we're not doing enough to prepare now for the future.
No, that's really interesting. And hopefully another time or later on, we can talk a bit more about what enough would look like in terms of how we need to focus on this. But turning the conversation quickly to sort of the banking and financial services sector in South Africa, from your point of view, right, as chief economist, can you tell us a little bit about, you know, what the current state of the banking and financial sector is in South Africa today?
And I think, you know, before I do that, just giving you a bit of background to the banking sector as well, if that's all right.
Yeah, of course.
So we can better understand it. So I think, you know, the real point of the financial services sector is that it supports the economy. It really is a system, you know, financial services, whether they're in South Africa or another country or anywhere in the world, and in fact, all of the systems together around the world as well, they're intricately linked into the economy they operate in, and of course, to other financial services systems and other economies. Yeah. And, you know, there is this strong symbiosis between the financial services sector, the banking sector particularly, and the economy that it's operating in. So both cannot survive successfully without the other. What you're really saying is, a weak economy, particularly one that's in structural decline, as South Africa experienced in the past decade, you know, we saw economic growth drop down from above 3% in 2011, really to 0.1%, the latest figures have shown us for 2019. We know it's a result of state capture, very high levels of corruption, the erosion and hollowing out of the state-owned entities. And of course, we see it now, you know, the legacy effects on Eskom, you know, our poor electricity supply, the railway system, you know, all of these factors, you know, an economy that's in a structural decline such as that, it limits the ability of the financial services sector to contribute and to strengthen economic growth and job creation. And this is because the banking system is an intermediary between other sectors of the economy. So it performs the vital functions of payment facilitation, you know, lending via deposit taking. People deposit money in banks, and the banks then lend that out to other clients, which is, of course, reflective of economic activity, how much is lent out, you know, as well as forming part of the economy itself, contributing to growth. And of course, you know, if we actually even look at the financial services system wider, the Reserve Bank itself determines interest rates and its monetary policy framework, you know, inflation targeting, which in turn influence the abilities of banks to lend, and of course stimulates or cuts back stimulus the economy, you know, in terms of the Reserve Bank's interest rates. And of course, you know, we're in a very high inflation environment at the moment, so we're seeing central banks around the world hiking rates to try and quell demand and actually pull back on the you know, strong inflationary pressures that we're having. But returning to South Africa's, you know, financial services system, it certainly accounts for insurance, banking, and the finance sector. So we need to remember that, you know, it's not the banking system on its own. And of course, that only accounts for about 7.3% of the economy. It's one of the middle-sized sectors. You know, people often look at the GDP breakdown. They see agriculture, construction, mining, you know, and they look through the economy, because financial services is listed as the top of a whole string of items that go into one of the service sectors, and you know it's about you know, around 20%. They often think it's only the banking system that accounts for that, but it's not. You know, that sector also includes all the different types of well, really all the different types of business services we have in South Africa. So you know, this when we actually have a look at the combination of these three sectors, real estate, business services, and financial services, it accounts for 24% of GDP in 2020. And of course, you know, as I said, on its own, the financial service sector only 7.3%. That means your real estate and business services are much bigger. So the banking system in turn is only just about half the size of the actual financial services sector. It's around about 5% of overall GDP, given the contribution from the insurance sector that we estimate. And of course, you know, the non-bank financial services sector, such as asset managers, they account for the remainder. So really, you know, we find if we have a look at what our business services, we know what real estate is. So what is the third leg, you know, business services, financial services, and of course, the three that I mentioned at the top, then of course you would obviously find yourself looking at the banking services, which are accountancy, legal consulting, marketing, event planning, software, IT, training, maintenance, public relations. And it's really important to note that that's the biggest sector. It accounts for 9.6% of GDP, and you know, the financial service sector only at 7.3%.
I have a question for you. So one of the things you mentioned is, right, you know, this idea that the financial sector, you know, supports and adds to economic growth. And I know that's a widely said term. Can you sort of drill down a bit into what does that mean? How does the banking and financial sector do these things? And you mentioned one of them as sort of like, you know, payment options and as an intermediary. Can you paint sort of a picture around how it actually supports and adds to economic growth?
Okay. One of South Africa's key strengths remains its financial services sector, defined here from an economic perspective as performing an intermediary function between borrowers and lenders, and so enabling the smooth function of the economy. South Africa's financial service industry has broadened over the past decade. It's become more inclusive of the differing income groups and also seen marked changes and ease of usage through embracing evolving technologies, while also being a key contributor to corporate social responsibility. Mm. Following international banking regulations and, of course, domestic bank supervision has resulted in a successful financial service industry with the banking sector enabling the functioning of the economy, as well as contributing to economic growth and as the economy strengthens. However, the financial services sector has been unable to perform to its full capacity as a lender due to the suppressed nature of economic demand, or really the demand for lending, if you know what I'm trying to say. So people actually increase borrowing in good times because they want to borrow substantially more, you know, to expand businesses. Yeah. And they often borrow less in bad times, although of course sometimes you do get some borrowing to help people who obviously are experiencing financial difficulties. So, you know, really South Africa is expected to see faster growth as an economy overall if the proposed structural growth oriented reforms are implemented. And of course, that includes your Operation Vulindlela, the ERRP plan, and of course, obviously, listening recently to the electricity plans as well from government. And that, of course, will lead to greater private sector fixed investment, with the financial services sector poised and, in fact, ready to invest into both public and private sector bankable projects. So we actually believe that South Africa's GDP growth could rise to about 4% by 2027, if not even higher, depending on obviously the global and domestic factors at the time, if we actually get this huge scale of fixed investment that's being planned by Operation Vulindlela, and of course, you know, the ERRP as well. And that's the key here, because investing in electricity infrastructure has a twofold effect. It both adds to the economic growth potential of the economy, and of course also the build program contributes to growth. And you know, the financial services sector in South Africa that really stands ready to lend into these projects, into strong bankable projects, and that also includes infrastructure on the rail system, the ports, and etc., because really it's these positive knock-on or multiplier effects which has been missing from South Africa's economy, which has really been depressing business confidence. And of course, you know, also the incentive to invest in physical infrastructure. If you want to build, you know, a large factory, but you're worried there's not going to be enough electricity, that also has a suppressing effect.
Yeah, definitely. Can you talk about some of the biggest challenges facing the sector? So I remember when I was reading the chapter, I think there's a bit where you talked about, you know, the impact, or I guess the negative impact of like government debt on the sector. Can you speak to some of these challenges that you're facing in the banking, but also in, I guess, the broader financial services sector?
Yes, definitely. So I think what you really see in South Africa, if you were to look at the saving industry, which is an easy way to break it down, there's really three pillars of saving or just saving in South Africa. And that's your corporate sector, your households, and of course, government. And government, as we know, is a dissaver. It borrows a huge amount. Whereas your households are a net saver, they're often close to zero, but they're a net saver, and corporates actually have substantially higher savings. And we'll unpack why that is just now. But nevertheless, there is a negative impact of high government debt on the banking sector, and in fact, even on private investment as well. And of course, that's where we really need better choices from government, which we're seeing under Minister Gondwana. We're seeing obviously a strong focus on containing government finances, on containing the debt situation, and really, you know, even as we see often in the media, trying to avoid further credit rating downgrades. We've actually found our rating stabilized recently. But really, South Africa's high level of state debt does increase the risk of default and, of course, the risk of a bankrupt and failed state. So there is that threat. But there's also a threat to the banking system, given its substantial holdings of state debt. So often when we're talking about the deposit-taking function of the financial services sector, the banking sector in South Africa, people put money into bank accounts, and then, of course, you know, the banks pay them interest. Now, the point really is that often this money is lent out again into government, and obviously purchases of government bonds then give the banking sector higher interest rates, and they can obviously use those interest rates to pay the people for the deposits that they take, for pay for staff at the banks, you know, other costs as well. So it's all part of the operation of the banking system. But the point really is that there is a threat to the banking sector given its very high holdings of government debt, if obviously government does fail, if it does obviously go bankrupt or default in its debt, or even just as government sees credit rating downgrades, because it also creates a negative risk for banks as well and increases their costs. In fact, this is actually flags a potential systemic risk to the financial services sector. You know, and a systemic risk is something which runs through the whole sector, so it'll affect all the banks. Right. To break this down, really, it's the high ownership of government debt by the financial services sector. And of course, this debt's often held by insurers as well and pension funds, not just banks. It's also a major threat to the stability of the South African's economy. I mean, you can imagine if the banking system collapses and the government debt system collapses, that'll have a hugely systemic effect right through the economy. This, as we were talking about earlier, also been exacerbated by the escalation in credit risk on South African government debt. And of course, we've seen a deterioration in credit ratings. And of course, the probability of default rises when your credit ratings drop down. That's all that credit ratings really show you. It's the ability to repay debt. So credit ratings agencies, they actually just assess the creditworthiness of the issuers of debt, and so, of course, of the ability for the debt to be repaid. Deteriorating sovereign credit ratings, of course, reduce the creditworthiness, the perceived creditworthiness of the financial sector as well as government, because no corporate, no business that is domiciled in South Africa or, you know, in a country can have a higher rating than the sovereign debt of that country. So, you know, that is a really, really key point. And of course, you know, South Africa's debt, equity and insurance markets are all integral to its financial services system and, of course, to a well-developed and well-functioning economy, contributing to the strength of the financial services system overall. So I think, you know, the key point here is that the majority of South Africa's sovereign debt is owned by the private sector. It's owned by South Africans, with only about a third owned by foreigners. And of course, you know, foreigners can be substantial sellers of South African debt. We saw that in 2020 in the pandemic, the financial market crisis in the March-April period. And of course, there was then a perception that, you know, there could be a deterioration in government finances as well, because those were already damaged from a prior decade of overspending. You know, in the 2010s decade, we're talking about the structural decline of the economy. So, you know, South Africa's banking system actually absorbed these foreign sales of government debt, you know, from 2020 as the foreigners sold it out. And of course, we obviously saw higher borrowing costs. And that also has seen private sector fixed investment crowded out by the high returns on government bond yields. I think that's an important point. You know, if you have money and you want to invest it into a business, which has a risk, you know, businesses can fail, or you could instead invest it in government debt, which is seen to be much more stable, and get this high interest rate payouts around 10%. I mean, that's a very good return. Then because government's a disaver and it just has such a very large amount of debt, it's very It's very enticing for the private sector to hold a lot of that debt and earn this high 10% interest rate payment, especially, you know, if your inflation rate is 7.8%, it's giving you still a real return. Mm-hmm. And, you know, in turn, that does crowd out monies that could instead be used for investing in the economy. Let's imagine that government debt was very low, like it was under the Thabo Mbeki period in the 2000s, not the escalation we saw under the Zuma period of the 2010s, that huge excessive amount of borrowing. So in the 2000s, our interest rate was about 6%. Now, if you can imagine now, and that's on, you know, your government bond yields, if you can imagine your bond yields are about 6%, then obviously there's less incentive now with inflation at 7.8 to buy bonds. You know what I'm trying to say? So that's one of the ways it actually crowds out investment. Now, why did the corporate sectors have such a high level of savings? Well, it comes back to the fact that corporates in South Africa do need to replace their deteriorated assets. And this is something that government often forgets. And of course, we see that with Eskom, with the rail system, they haven't put money aside to replace their failing power stations, their aging power stations. In fact, they have a huge amount of debt. Mm. So corporates have to keep money aside to replace the machinery that ages in their factories and all the infrastructure that the private corporate sector, you know, obviously uses to operate with. They don't replace all their IT systems, etc. Now, businesses can't just take money from the public like government does, you know, to replace its debt and just continuously borrow more. Yeah. You know, they'll actually go bankrupt. And that's why government finds itself in a special position where it is actually able to, you know, borrow so much because the corporates have got the savings to replace their own deteriorated infrastructure. Mm. But also as well, it's a risky system. You know, I hope I've managed to sort of lay that out.
Yeah, no, very well. Thank you so much. And I think, you know, we've sort of turned the conversation to exactly where I want to put it. But in the chapter, and I think that's basically the whole point of the book, Better Choices, is what would you say are the sort of top 3 to 4 strategies or recommendations that, you know, government needs to do to aid in the recovery of this sector, if I can even call it a recovery?
Well, I think, you know, we've talked at length about the government debt. And of course, we've seen very good work done by Minister Enoch Godondwana. It's unfortunate that there's obviously a political campaign happening in South Africa ahead of the the ANC Elective Conference towards the end of this year, the presidential elective conference, if you will, for the ANC, you know, which is trying to attack the Ramaphosa camp, attack ministers who are affiliated with them, you know, trying to paint them in a bad light. But obviously we won't go into all of that now. But the point really is that Minister Enoch Godondwana has really done a stellar job in stabilizing government finances, controlling government finances, and looking to actually work down our debt levels. An interesting point we haven't talked about yet is while South Africa has very high debt levels and also a high ratio, you know, compared to GDP, it actually increases further under the projections of the next 5 years or so, because government looks to borrow even more. And of course, that is a negative impact on our government finance. And a better choice for South Africa would be to actually reduce government debt. So the supply of debt, because they're looking to obviously issue more. That's why their debt projections rise over the next few years, to reduce the supply of debt. By reducing the supply of debt, you work it down. Under the Thabo Mbeki government, we actually saw debt buybacks, government buying back debt. It pulled down your yield on your bonds. You remember we said to 6% from the 10% now. We also saw a huge stimulatory impact on the economy. We saw massive investment by the private sector in the economy. And in fact, the economy grew from around 2% out to above 5% on a sustainable basis, you know, by the end of the period, by the 2008 period. Of course, then we had the financial crisis. We had Mbeki pushed out, Zuma coming in, and we had the huge deterioration in the economy and government finances, which then, of course, slowed growth. Something people forget as well is that in the 2000s, when we had the working down of government debt, we also had tax cuts. Of course, now over the last decade, the 2010s decade, the Zuma decade, instead we've had tax increases. Tax increases slow your economy. They weaken growth for obvious reasons. There's less money for people to spend. And the opposite happens when you get tax cuts. But overall, you know, the key point really is that by reducing government debt levels, we obviously would get credit rating upgrades. And of course, that would be positive for the rand, which then reduce petrol prices and in turn, obviously lower inflation. And of course, as well, we obviously would then move away from the risk of, you know, approaching debt default. People would be more interested in investing in South Africa. In fact, there's a very strong correlation between business confidence and government debt levels. Very high debt levels like we have often result in depressed business confidence. If you look at the past decade, the 2010s decade, the Zuma decade, business confidence was depressed the entire way through. And of course, that is because government debt rose substantially the entire way through as well. And if we actually have a look at the prior decade before that, we had very strong business confidence in the 2000s. And of course, government debt levels were worked down. So there wasn't a crowding out of the of private sector investment. There was a crowding in of private sector investments in the 2000s and a crowding out in the 2010s.
Yeah, I saw a point in the chapter was where you talked about, you know, I think it's like increasing freedom for businesses to operate and reducing heavy regulation. It would be good to hear a bit about what some of those regulations are and what it would look like for businesses to be freer to operate in South Africa.
Just to sum up some of the points I've been talking about, South Africa is expected to see faster growth if the proposed structural growth orientated reforms are implemented. And we're talking about electricity sector, the ports, the railway system, leading to greater private sector fixed investment, with the banking sector ready to lend to the private sector, because obviously a lot of the reforms that President Ramaphosa has proposed have been to include the private sector more heavily, with the resulting in much better choices. We're already seeing this coming through from the president. Of course, we also talked about better choice from government in terms of lowering borrowing to lessen the crowding out of the private sector, fixed investment from the economy. But better choices on the behalf of government is also required to reduce its stifling control of the economy, and in particularly to reduce the strangling regulatory hold that we actually have in some areas. Yeah. So increasing the business freedom to operate is actually very key for South Africa to have a strong economic growth trajectory, along with repairing the structural weaknesses of the state-owned entities, eliminating corruption, and achieving a quick turnaround time from government regulators and bureaucracy. This is really important because government needs to create the environment for the private sector to thrive and, of course, to obviously work down unemployment as well. You know, we cannot have a system where people have to wait for very long times to obviously obtain their permits. We obviously have poor governance in state-owned entities. Transnet has been in the news recently talking about how much money it's costing to try and keep the system operating, but they're not keeping it operating at capacity. They've actually been cutting back on their delivery contracts. And of course, you know, overall, if we look at the regulatory environment in South Africa, if we look at the World Bank's ranking on the ease of doing business, South Africa is seen to have one of the more stifling regulatory environments. It doesn't have a very easy, it's not at the top with the countries that are the easiest to do business in. It's actually one of the ones which found it much more difficult to do business in. That doesn't mean the government hasn't done a lot to try and increase the ease of doing business. And of course, we see a lot of that with the ability to apply online electronic applications for many of the bureaucratic processes you need to go to. But it's also that other countries around the world move quicker than South Africa. You know, if other countries are increasing their ease of doing business much faster than South Africa is, you're still not going to be competing very well. And it comes back to country competitiveness in particular.
No, great point on that. Thank you so much for that. And do you want to touch
on climate change?
Briefly before you wrap up?
Yes. Yeah. Talking about climate change and the responsibility of the banking sector, in particular, climate change has many negative consequences for the poor and for developing economies, and especially for those whose governments are over indebted. The need to phase out fossil fuels is well understood. And of course, you know, this particularly looks at coal, gas, oil, all of those. It's something which is seen to need to actually come to a halt if we are to see the climate change objectives achieved by 2050. So clearly globally we need to find our path to using energy supplies that are cost effective in achieving clean, dynamic and resilient energy economies that are dominated by renewables like solar and wind instead of fossil fuels. And this is an area the banking sector can play an influential role in rejecting fossil fuel projects and encouraging clean projects in its credit assessments. In particular, we know we do acknowledge that gas will probably be a bridging fuel under the sweeping energy transition. We're already seeing it, you know, being a bridging fuel. But the point really is that if we do not see these strong efforts made to reduce the dependence on fossil fuels and transition away to a zero emission global economy, we stand at huge risk of seeing global heating move above the 2% mark and actually out towards the 3 to 4% mark, measured since the Industrial Revolution, of course, which then would result in very severe climate change effects. We're already seeing some of them around the world. We're seeing earlier autumns, earlier springs coming through, more extreme weather events, more damaging weather events. And of course, as well, again, coming back to the negative impact it has on food security, and of course, the negative impact it has in terms of creating a downward spiral. You know, if you get overheating, you get extreme weather events, you don't pull back on your emissions, and then that can exacerbate and just get worse and worse as well. And it really is something which will have a negative effect on government finances as well. We already saw the effect from COVID on many economies. Climate change would actually have a worse effect, we think, on government finances around the world, because it would be a long-term devastating impact as opposed to the quicker impact that we saw from COVID-19. Remember as well, that was self-imposed. You know, economies themselves choosing to lock down and when to reopen. Whereas with climate change, you can't do that. You know, if you have a very dire climate change environment that wipes out food production, we've certainly seen that already happening in certain areas of South America. You know, government has to step in to help failing businesses, failing agricultural ventures, but more broadly, you know, throughout the economy, help with food security. And of course, there's the negative effects of rising sea levels, the negative effects on property from climate change, weather events as well, whether it's extreme precipitation. All of these just have a very strong high cost effect. So I think that it is something that we spoke about at the start of this presentation, where we felt that there wasn't enough focus coming through in terms of achieving the objectives of climate change. You know, the Russian-Ukraine war following so closely from the COVID pandemic has shifted priorities and expectations, but we really are finding ourselves in a situation where scientists globally are starting to worry that we're on the hothouse scenario, we're on the worst case path of global warming of 3 to 4%. And that's very, very worrying for the future of the world.
Yeah, no, definitely. And I really appreciate you sort of linking this topic to, you know, the banking and financial sector, because that's the kind of forward thinking that we need to be doing in terms of finding creative and innovative ways to address this issue. But that
yes,
brings
I agree.
Us
you
to
know,
the
I think,
end of this episode, Annabelle.
I was going to add quickly. Yeah. You know, I agree completely. Yeah. I mean, the financial services sector is extremely well poised to create change in withdrawing funding for fossil fuel projects and is already making many of these better choices while supporting green alternatives. But of course, this does need to be done sympathetically for jobs and companies already in the fuel industries, with alternative support mechanisms appropriate to engender the change towards clean energy.
Yeah, no, definitely. Annabelle Bishop, thank you so much for the time. It's been an absolute pleasure.
Thank you so much.
That brings us to the end of today's show. I hope you enjoyed it as much as I did putting it together. I love learning new things. Hey, if you enjoyed this chat, you definitely enjoy others that came before it. Check out previous episodes on whichever platform you're tuned into now, or visit our website www.thebrentersfoundation.org for other episodes. As always, thank you so much for listening. And if I could make one last ask of you, please do share this with others. Again, you're listening to Marie Noel on the Brentes Foundation podcast, and it's been a pleasure sharing this time with you. Until next week, stay well.